if you are ready, we can go ahead and talk.
Fantastic.
Okay. At the very beginning of your book, Uncreative Writing, you say literature is in a rut. Why? What makes you say that?
Well, one of the problems is sort of formulaic. MFAs are teaching certain ways how to write, and people are writing that way. And Hollywood film scripts are made from those kinds of books. And everything is becoming a little bit homogenous. You know, we're falling back on what we know and mistaking it probably for what we like because we don't know anything else.
But my sense is your critique goes deeper than that, that you think that we are mired in old ways of thinking about what makes creative writing.
Well, I mean, you know, our relationship to language over the last 10 years has radically changed. And that is due to the internet and to the digitization of language, which suddenly creates a different landscape for the writer and also for the reader, completely different. And it's not just about format. So I'm not talking about the Kindle, because the Kindle really doesn't change writing very much. That's more of a platform. But I'm actually thinking about the way that the linguistic landscape. And so you know, on the internet, when everything is made of language and everything is digital, it is up to writers now to actually respond to that environment.
But so, tell me why. I mean, why is this? I mean, obviously, the internet has had a profound impact on all of our lives, but it's not clear why this would affect what creative writers do. I mean, why is the task different now than it was, I don't know, 15 years ago?
Well, because of a little thing called copy and paste. And, you know, the amount of language that's available on the internet now and the ease of it. I often say that you have a lot of writers using appropriative techniques now in ways that were impossible to do before. It used to take a lot of work to retype a novel. That's one of the reasons nobody ever did it. But because of Shakespeare's entire oeuvre is available on the internet with a quick cut, you know, copy, cut, and paste, and you've got the entire thing sitting in your Microsoft Word program, it creates a very different way of working with language. Language is now material. Language is something to mold and to shape, as opposed to something to create from scratch.
But cutting and pasting is not the image that most people have of what creative writers do. That's what hacks do. At least I think that's the conventional thinking.
Well, that is the conventional thinking. But there's been a whole century of explorations into other ways of writing that actually take into account these appropriative ideas. For example, it's not just writing. If we look at music, you know, music is much of the most popular music is made entirely from cutting and pasting. Nobody would dare play drums on a track today. You sample drums. You know, this is happening in art. 100 years ago, Marcel Duchamp took a urinal and recontextualize it, didn't do a thing to it, just put it into a different context, and that's already 100 years old, and that's old hat. Somehow, writing has never engaged with these ideas that are rampant all over the rest of culture.
So you're saying the digital media has challenged writers to do something different, maybe to be more experimental, and in the process to give up some of our old ideas about what creative writing is all about, what originality is all about.
Well, I mean, I actually don't think that this is really that unoriginal. As a matter of fact, you can cut and paste in very original and very unique and very expressive ways. You can create an entire novel that you haven't written that nobody else could write by the way that you've cut, pasted, and sewn it together. I mean, this, again, of course, goes right back to hip-hop tracks and things that nobody even would think about. Think twice about in other parts of culture.
Well, you in your book, you cite the literary critic Marjorie Perloff, who has talked about the unoriginal genius, and she says the main creative task these days is moving information rather than dreaming up something from scratch.
Well, she means that in two ways. She means moving information literally in the Duchampian way of moving something from one place to another. But she also means moving in terms of emotionally moving. You know, I mean, this is not simply cold. Language is not neutral. Language is really loaded. And no matter what you do with it, it will retain meaning. So it's actually quite moving. I gave a reading, actually, two nights ago in Madrid in a small apartment. And I read works that I hadn't written. And when I looked up after my reading, the audience, several audience members, were in tears. Now, it was very moving stuff that I was reading, but of course I didn't write it. So, you know, the idea that this is sort of mechanical and cold is a kind of a misreading of these ideas.
What did you read in Madrid?
Well, I read from a work of mine called Seven American Deaths and Disasters, and those are transcriptions of national tragedies that have happened in America. There's a transcription of the Kennedy assassination, John F. Kennedy. There's a transcription of the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. There's a transcription of an air check that was done the night John Lennon was killed. There is the Space Shuttle Challenger. There is the 9/11 call from Columbine. There is the 9/11 broadcasts of people describing the building going down. And finally, there is the live announcement of Michael Jackson's death.
So when you say you read transcriptions of these, just straight transcriptions, I mean, obviously you picked out the passages that you wanted to read, or did you kind of edit them in some way to make them more artful?
Absolutely not. And they're artful as they are. You know, the idea of this body of work was, how do we describe, what language do we use to describe that which we never thought we'd see in our life or have to express? And there's so much bias, there's so much prejudice, there's so much suspicion. I mean, the 9/11 descriptions are loaded with prejudice against the other. You know, this is supposed to be neutral, but there is no neutral language. Language is always slanted and biased in many ways, but we don't think about it. You know, there have been many books that have been written on the World Trade Center, you know, gazillion of them, and yet I don't think any of them have ever listened to the narration of the towers falling and tried to understand what that language was that was being used there. I mean, it's very moving, and it's also quite cliched. So it depends on what you're choosing to transcribe for what emotional effect. It's a matter of picking and choosing, and this, of course, is very personal.
Well, I have to ask you about an event that you were part of, actually at the White House, so President and Mrs. Obama's celebration of American poetry, and I know you read some of your work there, including a piece called Traffic. Can you tell me about this work, Traffic?
Well, I mean, it's a transcription on New York Radio. We have wonderful traffic here in New York. And New York News Radio, a wonderful station that's very old called 1010 Winds, is round-the-clock news. It's the one that has the old teletype sound still in the background of the broadcast. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Every 10 minutes, they give the traffic report. So this was a book that was 24 hours of worth of traffic reports every 10 minutes on the ones, as they say.
Could you give us a sample of this? Do you have traffic in front of you?
I sure do.
I'm wondering, something fairly short, maybe, I don't know, between a minute, minute and a half or so?
I will read what I read to the president. How about that?
That would be great.
It's 2 minutes because each one is 1 minute long.
Okay.
And so I can't do a minute and a half. I've got to do 1 minute for one and 1 minute for the next. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. 4:21. And we are still going to have to get through a pretty bad rush hour. Already we've got major delays on 7th and 8th Avenues as you make your way through the Midtown area. 7th Avenue delays begin right out of Central Park, all the way down through Times Square. Broadway's impacted, obviously, 9th and 10th Avenue seeing more traffic as well, but not as bad as heading through the Times Square area. Meanwhile, on the east side, it's a torture test because a lot of the side streets are taking a beating, especially through the 40s and 50s. That will impact traffic at the 59th Street Bridge, which is jammed coming into Manhattan. Right now, you've also got jam-ups on the Brooklyn Bridge, bumper to bumper to Brooklyn, but the lower roadway is wide open. The Brooklyn Bridge is swamped. The FDR Drive's not looking too good either, bumper to bumper right off the Manhattan Bridge. Meanwhile, the West Side delays begin in the 70s, and they go south all the way to the Battery Tunnel. 431. Remember how bad it was yesterday? It's starting again. The east side delays begin at the Tarboro. It's pretty much one long line now all the way to the Battery. The west side delays to the Battery begin back at the Boat Basin at 79th Street. We've got a ton of interior traffic in Midtown. 7th Avenue, Times Square, that's the delay. That's where it all gets going. It comes out of Central Park. Broadway and 8th Avenue is going to be impacted by that as well. On the east side, side streets are packed through the 40s and 50s, and that's why 1st, 2nd, 3rd, Park Avenue right now, an absolute mess. So trying to get around Manhattan, just like yesterday, is not going to be easy at all. Across the East River, already a ton of traffic each way on the Brooklyn Bridge. Now the Manhattan Bridge is bumper to bumper coming into Manhattan, jam-packed on the upper roadway to Brooklyn. The lower roadway is also a mess. 59th Street Bridge is getting real bad. The belt is jammed east off the Verrazano. Some types of problems on the way west toward Coney Island. And right now, heavy transit delays. Be sure to budget extra travel time taking the LIRR out of Penn Station.
So that's what I read
traffic reports to the President of the United States.
And how did that go over at the White House?
They loved it. They absolutely loved it. You know, it was very funny because I had to put together a little, I chose to put together a little set about an American icon, the Brooklyn Bridge. And so I read three short pieces, an excerpt from Walt Whitman's Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, written in 1840 before there was a bridge there. And then I went through Hart Crane's poem about the Brooklyn Bridge, which is a kind of a disjunctive modernist thing. And then finally ended up with Traffic, what I just read for you. Now, the audience, who was really, you know, senators and mayors and, you know, Democratic party donors, sat there very politely and quietly through the Whitman and the Crane, the real poetry. But when they heard the traffic reports,
they were laughing, I bet.
They were howling. And by the in between the break, between 421 and 431, they started whooping and hollering. And you know, there's a shot of Obama leaning back in his chair with a giant smile across his face, listening to the traffic report. So you see, the thing is, you know, maybe it's vernacular. I mean, maybe this is just language that people can understand, right? I mean, who understands Hart Crane? Who cares about Hart Crane? Nobody. Nobody cares about real poetry. What people care about is kind of the language that's around them. And of course, you know, these are Washington bureaucrats, so they had ideas about gridlock and congestion and delay. You know, there's a bit of, you know, there really is narrative in there as well, in a way that Whitman gives you impression or Crane gives you disjunction. You know, I'm actually giving you narrative. So, but I didn't write any of these, you know. So this is the weird thing. The most avant-garde, the most unoriginal, the most uncreative work was the work that went over the very best in the White House.
Well, I have to ask you then about another project that you did a few years ago, which you called Day. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. That was a that was a retyping of a day's copy of the New York Times. It was a kind of an off news day. Nothing special happened. I began typing the newspaper from the upper left-hand part of each page down to the lower right-hand part, respecting the columns. I didn't want to write across the columns. I just simply copied the thing and moved from column to column. When I was done with one page, turned the next page.
New York Times, the whole issue of one day of the New York Times.
Yeah, and I published it as a 900-page book, and it's really the best work of literature that's ever been written. You know, of course, I didn't write a word of it, but it's got love, it's got hate, it's got betrayal, it's got triumph, it's got victory, it's got tragedy, it's got defeat, you know, it's, I mean, it's a marvelous thing, and it's being written 900 times a day around the world and then being discarded only to be written again. So this is the kind of recontextualization that I'm talking about.
But why in the world would you want to do this? Retype 900 pages worth of the New York Times? It sounds incredibly boring, for one thing.
It was really boring. I'm the most boring writer that's ever lived. I mean, I can't even read my own books. They're so boring. But the point is, really, the books are impossible to read. You know, my books are absolutely horrible. I can't read them. But they're wonderful to talk about. So the kind of conversation that we're having right now is really what the books are all about. And this is why we call this conceptual writing. I don't have a readership. I have a thinkership.
Hmm. Well, in fact, near the end of that book, didn't you say something like regurgitation is the new uncreativity?
It sounds like something I would have said. You know, it was very funny. I did a radio interview about Day one time, and the host began asking me, "Do you know this name?" This is just cold. "Do you know this name?" And I said, "No, I don't know that name." "Do you know this company?" "No, I don't know this company." And he said, and it goes on and on for a few minutes. And he says, "Well, these are all in your book. And, you know, your book Day." And of course I don't know them. Do you think I actually read the damn thing? I mean, I was just typing. So, you know, I can be surprised by my own books. I don't know my own books. And I can pick them up and I can not recognize them at all. It's wonderful. They never die for me. And again, this is one of the old problems with narratives, is that, you know, you don't want to see that movie again, you know. But I do want to see movies that are non-narrative. I mean, I can stick with, you know, not to be such a, you know, such an art snob about it, but I can see a Godard film again. I can see a Lars von Trier film over and over again and find new things in it. Hollywood films, I like them too, but I'm done with them very quickly. I'm bored with them, and it's sort of the way I feel about pop music as well.
Hmm. How long did it take you to transcribe that issue of the New York Times?
Oh, about a year and a half.
My goodness. I mean... I mean, I understand sort of conceptually it's kind of interesting, but that's a long haul to do something that sounds awfully boring.
Well, that's what artists do. You know, artists dedicate their lives to absurdity. You know, some of them, you know, can make it out of that. Most artists, of course, don't, and spend their life being absurd. This is what we do. You know, you guys go to work. We just are silly, you know, spend our life being silly. And this is the beauty of art, really. It was a wonderful year, and it was...
So you enjoyed doing that?
I loved it. It was meditative. It was relaxing. I didn't have to worry about what I was going to do for the next year. It was just, it was one of the best years I ever spent. But, you know, I've written many books like this.
I guess this is the literary equivalent of Andy Warhol pointing his camera at the Empire State Building for, what was it, 7 hours, 9 hours, something like that?
Yeah, eight hours. And, of course, Warhol said that those films were never meant to be watched. He said, "You come into one of my films and the audience becomes, the action in the audience becomes the action, not the action on screen." You have to remember, Warhol is merely a mirror. So people are so bored, they start talking to each other. You know, of course, many people in the 60s had sex in the theater while they were watching it, taking drugs, getting bored, leaving, coming, going, eating, sleeping. And suddenly the theater space becomes the performance space. And of course, all of these works are very Warholian in that way.
Now, you are not only a writer, you're also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and you teach a class called Uncreative Writing. Can you tell me about this class?
Sure. In this class, students are penalized for any shred of originality or creativity that they show. They must be they must be uncreative for an entire semester.
And, meaning they can only, what they write can only be taken from other sources, copied?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They can only appropriate, transcribe, copy, you know, the kind of stuff that I do.
And why is this the requirement of the class?
Well, the idea is to move away from what you know. Now, as a college professor, I can get them better at writing, but quite frankly, at the University of Pennsylvania, they all know how to write pretty well, and particularly, you know, at upper levels. So what are we going to do? We're going to keep honing that short story so you can, you know, market it. That's fine. It's somebody else's job. My job is really to challenge them and to get them to think differently about what writing is and what the creative process is. We do exercises, and one of the best exercises we do is I just tell them simply, with no further instruction, I say, retype 5 pages. And they shrug their shoulders and they leave the class. But the next week, they come in with the assignment, 5 pages, and that's where it gets very interesting. What did you choose to type? How did you choose to type? How did you actually choose to type it? Why did you choose to type it? And suddenly, all these autobiographical ideas and ideas of choices and tastes all come into the seemingly innocuous idea of retyping 5 pages. And suddenly, they go, aha, this is, I wasn't thinking about that, but of course I was making choices, and making choices is a uncreative/creative act.
But you're also, it sounds like, asking your students to plagiarize what someone else has already written, right?
Absolutely.
Which is the kind of thing that usually gets students kicked out of school.
Well, you know, I encourage plagiarism. You know, you must plagiarize in my class. You know, these kids are so good at plagiarism, but they always have to do it surreptitiously. And, you know, in my class, I say, you know, you may not do it surreptitiously. You've got to put it all out on the table. Now tell me why you did it. Let's get responsible about your plagiarism. What choices did you make? You're not, you know, when kids plagiarize, they're not really thinking about the sort of formal choices that they're making. So it becomes an enlightening thing. Now, of course, this is quite, academically, you know, this is really the worst thing you can do. As a matter of fact, at the end of each class, I make them buy a term paper from a paper mill and put their name to it and turn it in as their final project. But then they've got to get up and they've got to defend it as if it's theirs.
But you're supporting a corrupt industry of, you know, the people who write those term papers for someone else and for someone else's name.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are, and the best time is when we can get university funds to actually purchase these papers.
I can't imagine how this goes over with other professors, with other writers. Some people must be furious at you.
No, nobody's furious. You know, listen, no animals were harmed during the making of this movie. This is safe. This is consensual. It's like an S&M club. You know, you go in and you role play and everybody's cool with it. You know, and those are the rules. Of course, you know, this is the thing about a classroom. I mean, it's controlled and it's safe and really nobody's really getting hurt here.
So what do you think students learn by taking your uncreative writing class?
Well, I mean, they learn to make decisions and they learn to become accountable. I mean, everything must be articulated. You know, actually, it's more like what I would assume law school is like. You have to learn to take somebody else's point of view, even if you don't believe it. I mean, this is happening sort of in the legal profession all the time. So you're getting outside of yourself. You're adopting things that aren't yours. You're judging language in a very different way than you've ever seen it. And the best thing that can come out of this, I think, is one of the great things is that they reject this way of working. You know, I say, look, suspend your disbelief for a semester. And then if you don't like this way of working, you can actually say, again, it's defensible. I've tried it and I don't like it. This is crap. But often what happens is this becomes another tool in a writer's toolbox. And I think this is actually a very contemporary tool for writers to be using.
It sounds like you're saying that even though you call your class uncreative writing, this is an exercise in creativity.
Well, as I started, you know, saying like at the beginning, creativity is sort of so formulaic and so sort of bankrupt at this point that it's really, I think, the thing to flee from.
Why is it bankrupt though? I mean, there are
creativity is not creative. It's the 100,000th coming of age novel. I want to talk about these shortlist for the 2011 Man Booker Prize shortlist.
Okay.
And four of the six shortlisted novels advertise themselves as featuring immigrants negotiating the difficulties of a strange land. Five of the six hinge on the dramatic turn of a murder. Four of the six reveal secrets from the past that come unexpectedly to light. I mean, this is from the website of the Man Booker, okay? Half of those through the surprise arrival of a letter. Four of the six reveal the unreliability of narration and so on. So, you know, they're all kind of formulaic. And this is what's passing really for the, you know, for the very, you know, the what we're calling the best literature. That's not creative to me.
So you're saying there's nothing new to be said anymore. It's all just rehashing what someone else has already written.
Well, you know, I think there are new things to be said. You know, and I think there are, you know, sort of who hasn't been moved by a beautiful memoir or by a beautiful novel. I don't want to be so prescriptive in that way. But again, I feel that we've limited ourselves to these sort of same variations on narratives. And it's kind of time to open up the field a little bit more to other ways of being, those ways perhaps being uncreative or unoriginal.
But I think the response that you get from a lot of novelists is it's not just the themes that matter. It's the way you put together the sentences. It's the use of language to create imaginative spaces. Are you saying that's not important, or we've just misrepresented that?
No, I'm saying that is important, but I'd actually say that the way that those texts are constructed are fairly conventional and fairly similar. You know, there's a whole century of experimentation with language, which is completely ignored. There's many, many ways to construct novels. We actually just tend to construct novels quite similarly. So, just a call to open things up. Let's get a little more contemporary.
So do you have a dream uncreative project that's kind of in the back of your mind that you'd love to do at some point?
Well, I do them. And the project I'm working on right now is a rewriting of Walter Benjamin's Arcades project, his great 1,000-page work that was mostly about 75% or 80% plagiarized about Paris in the 19th century. I'm doing the identical task for New York in the 20th century.
But you're just copying what he wrote.
No, I'm actually using his identical process to write a book that transposes his process onto the 20th century in New York. So anyway, what I'm doing is I'm reading through the entire corpus of literature written about New York in the 20th century, and I'm note-taking the most interesting parts of those books, just copying passages down, and then filing them into different categories. And that will be the end result. The book will be done when it is as long as Walter Benjamin's project, which was about 1,000 pages.
And do you always cite your sources?
Well, it's funny. I go back and forth on that. Right now, they're not cited. They're footnoted. And I can actually see the language better when I don't see where it's from. I don't want to kind of know where it's from. I'm not sure about that question yet. I've been working on this book for 6 years, and I'm still not sure about that. But one thing I know is that I don't want a single word of my own to be in this book. And really, it's a magnificent failure, the way that you can't possibly, number one, read through the entire corpus of literature written on New York in the 20th century. Number two, you can't accurately describe New York in the 20th century in any kind of convincing way. So this is poetry. This is not a book of history, although it's historically based.
Well, I guess I wish you to fail magnificently then.
Well, that's what artists like. Artists like failure. You know, we try to fail. Failure is inherent in what we do. You know, there's great risk in what we do. And I think your question about kind of ideal or utopian ideas, we always strive for that and we always fall short.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you too.
This was a lot of fun.